Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and I gotta admit, I'm a little nervous. It's not every day where you get to meet the Queen. No, not that Queen. I'm talking about Big Frida, the Queen of Bounce. Bounce is the booty-obsessed style of hip-hop from New Orleans, and Big Frida, real name Freddie Ross, is not only the Queen, she's also a larger-than-life character with two dogs, Rita and Sensation, and her own reality TV show called Big Frida, the Queen of Bounce. I like this scene where Frida is talking about one of her dogs who has just been given a pink mohawk haircut.
Rita, my poodle, she's very diva-ish. She has that bitchy attitude. She is very smart. She's alert. She is a handful, honey. She wants to be the head diva of the house.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's not going to happen. Not in a house with Big Frida in it. Diva, dancer, rapper, queen, she'll join us later. Plus, live music from the electropop band Polisa, and an eyewitness account of that moment in London when punk became new wave. But first, we got an email last week from Spoonbill Books in Brooklyn. They were looking to shore up their selection of music books, and especially books by or about women in music. The email came from Elena Jones, a book buyer at the store, and, you know, we could have just answered her email with a list of books we like here at Soundcheck, but where's the fun in that? So instead, we've called the bookstore, and we're going to enlist your help in answering their question. Elena Jones, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about Spoonbill and Sugartown Booksellers, to give it its full name.
We're a bookstore right in the heart of Williamsburg on Bedford Avenue, and we've been here for about 14 years. And we have a large selection of art, architecture, graphic design books. We use books of all types. We have a large fiction section, small poetry section, and we have a small music section, but it's frequently visited, and we're always looking for ways to improve all of the sections.
Right. So when you sent us this email, the subject was, help us, Soundcheck, like a cry from the first Star Wars movie or something.
Yeah.
It was specifically to try and fill some holes of music books by and about women, right?
Right. And we have a few very strong sellers in that area. But, you know, if you
like
just go over to the music section, well, Just Kids, we've sold thousands. We'll sell at least two copies a day.
Patti Smith. Yeah.
We also have a book about Joni Mitchell, Will You Take Me As I Am, by Michelle Mercer. We've just picked up the book She Bop by Lucy O'Brien, which is about the history of women in popular music. And another bestseller is Bad Reputation, which is about Joan Jett.
So you've got a couple of you're off to a decent start there. But so you're looking. Has it been hard to find books about women in music?
It has been. I mean, there are countless books about Ella Fitzgerald and Billie Holiday, but there aren't really any books about, you know, while there'll be books and books and books about the punk scene, they often focus on, you know, maybe the Ramones, bigger players in the punk scene, but bands like the Slits or the Raincoats, you know, I haven't found any books about them, and they were major players, too.
Sure.
And so, you know, there are books out there, but we're also looking, I guess, for a specific kind of book that fits in with the music we feature. We tend towards the John Cage, Lou Reed track. The audience, our customers, are looking more for a slightly more contemporary...
Something with a little more edge to it.
Exactly, yeah.
All right, so over the next couple of days, we're going to ask our guests about their favorite books about women in music. But Soundcheck listeners, we need to hear from you, too. We want your recommendation for a great book about women in music. It can be a biography of a musician, a history of a movement, a music book written by a woman. Give us your recommendation by posting a comment on our website, soundcheck.org, or tweet us at Soundcheck. or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. We might even play your message on the air. That's 866-939-1612. And, of course, we'll pass all of the suggestions along to you, Elena, there at Spoonbill Books. You looking forward to getting more answers to your question than you ever intended?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to being flooded with suggestions.
All right. Well, Elena, thanks for your email, and we'll be in touch.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay, listeners, what books should Spoonbill be stocking by or about women in music? If you're stumped, don't worry. We've compiled a list of some great books by or about women that we've featured on the show. It may jog your memory or spark an idea or two. So head on over to our website, soundcheck.org. But now, a little guy time. When the British band The Jam released this song, Boy About Town, in 1980, they could well have been singing about Tony Fletcher. Tony, as you may know from his past appearances on Soundcheck, wrote the best-selling biographies of drummer Keith Moon, the band R.E.M., The Smiths, and more. But in 1980, Tony was a teenage kid with a fanzine in South London, and his new book, also called Boy About Town, is a memoir of his early years as an uncool kid with very cool tastes in music. Tony, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, John.
Any chance The Jam really had you in mind when they wrote Boy About Town?
I guess I doubt it. It's one of those things that I never asked. It never, ever, ever occurred to me at the time because I was just blissfully going through this existence. And it was only when I would go to jam gigs and be jumping about down the front and get the song dedicated to me. And The Jam never dedicated songs to anybody. And two or three times that song would be dedicated to me for jumping about down the front. And so really only later on did I actually sit and think, well, is it possible? I don't know. I don't know. But it certainly works for the book, for sure.
And as you say at one point in the book, there are lyrics here that kind of describe your life. There's the line, upstreet, downstreet, like paper caught in the wind. And you basically spent your teenage years on the tube and on the buses going hither and yon in London distributing your little, mimeographed fanzine.
Exactly. I'd have a sports bag that would have some of my school books, but really more copies of my fanzine. And after school, I would jump on a bus, not south towards my home, but north over the river. I'd stop in at studios, record shops, etc. And yeah, that was my life.
Yeah. Now, as much as the book is about a period in your life, it is also about an incredible period in the music scene in England and in London specifically. And The Jam have a kind of important role to play early on and through the book. How did that happen?
Probably the best way to describe that, go back very quickly to the fact that in the mid-70s, for those of us who were looking for some music that spoke to us more than progressive rock, The Who seemed to be the only band that still had their feet on the ground. And a lot of us at school, I was somebody who felt like, oh, I wish I'd been around for The Who in the 60s. And The Jam came along. You know, basically, punk happened in 76, 77. I was only 12, 13 at the time, so me and my own school friends didn't catch it with the first wave. We never saw the Sex Pistols or the Clash at that point. Older kids in our school may have done because our school was right by the river. But somewhere in the spring of 77, some of these records started getting in the charts on Top of the Pops. My memory is actually hating The Jam the first time I saw them, and it's one of these things when music, new music comes along and it's rebellious. To me, I'd been raised musically, and it sounded, I think I used the word brittle and sharp and ugly. They were on Top of the Pops in the summer of 77, but I ended up buying a single by them, actually, because I went to the store to buy God Save the Queen, and it was sold out, the Sex Pistols song.
The Sex Pistols version.
And yeah. I actually sort of fell in love with the cover for the Jam single All Around the World, because it looked so mod. And I brought it home, and it's one of those epiphanies where I played it. I was like, this is rubbish. I wish I hadn't bought it. Played it again. It's still rubbish, but, you know, play it again. And over this course of playing it half a dozen or 10 times, my life changed in those few minutes. And The Jam were basically a Who for our generation.
For your generation, yes. Yeah. The Jam, as I say, appear early and often in Tony Fletcher's memoir, Boy About Town, which takes place, Tony, in a fascinating period of time where punk is developing and post-punk is like right on its heels, a new wave and two-tone, and it's just like this one wave of stuff after another crashing over you.
It was an extraordinary time to live through. Of course, we thought it was normal because that's what we were going through. I think the most exciting part of it, I just mentioned about, you know, we were one, me and my school friends and the people I started my fanzine with and went to gigs with, were one step removed from punk. So we catch the new wave part of it. There's a lot in there about seeing bands like the Undertones, the Rizzillos, the stuff that's really like power pop and fun. There's a mod revival that we were around for, which we look back on somewhat embarrassingly now. But the exciting part, I think, is what I call the DIY era, which was me doing a fanzine, hundreds of fanzines across the UK.
Yeah.
And hundreds of groups pressing their own records. The means of production opened up and people would just find a way. You could press your own records, photocopy the sleeves, and there were record stores like Rough Trade and Small Wonder to sell them at. And it was so vibrant. And the music didn't need to sound professional anymore. In fact, almost the less professional, the more interesting. And that, when I look back, is the part of it that I'm almost most thrilled to have lived through, that idea of anything was possible creatively. Yeah.
So when I sort of introduced you in this segment today as the uncool kid with the cool taste in music, was that pretty much who you were as a 12, 13-year-old?
I think at the age of 12, 13, 14, I was an uncool kid in many, many ways. I developed very late. And I don't think I was very cool as a kid. I wasn't sporty, even though I liked football. Mm. My voice didn't break till I was about 16. And as a result, that got me bullied at school. We were growing up in quite a tough environment.
Right.
But I did have, once I got the fanzine going and these doors opened to me, suddenly I'm meeting cool musicians.
But before that happened, this happened.
Could it be forever? Or am I just wasting time? Well, I don't think so, cause you let me know. You make me feel like you're mine. Well, I feel like you're mine and I can't remember when the feelings have been stronger.
Tony Fletcher, care to explain yourself?
Yeah, you threw that one on me. The opening, number 50 in the rundown is Could It Be Forever. It's the first single I ever bought. It's David Cassidy.
From the Partridge Family.
From the Partridge Family. Now, I have to say, going back, and because so many people have said since the book came out, wow, you admit to this uncool first choice, that I don't think it's that bad a song. And I would love to hear one of these new kind of retro soul singers take it on. I'd love to hear someone like Charles Bradley take that song on.
Mm.
You know, it was co-written by Wes Farrell, who wrote Boys. Mm-hmm. And I actually don't. It's funny. I was more embarrassed writing about the David Cassidy obsession. It was my first music obsession. I moved very quickly on to Alice Cooper, so I think I get a pass.
Well, I couldn't give you a pass like that. And I know from your website that you've been getting a little stick from some of your friends about this as well.
So. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I had to pile on.
That's okay.
Tony Fletcher's book is called Boy About Town, and he does very quickly move from David Cassidy onto, getting caught up in this culture of punk, of fanzines. The two sort of grew up hand in hand, didn't they? The idea that you could start a band or you could start your own magazine.
Absolutely. There was always a vibrant British music press. There were four weekly papers back then, about three of which probably sold 200,000 a week, which is a lot in a small country. But they were very late getting onto punk. And, fanzines, you can compare it to blogs these days, but a fanzine required printing it. It required going home, typing it, cutting things up, laying it out, and then finding somebody to print it, which was really the hardest part. And then you had to walk around and sell it, which meant going into record stores. Would you like to sell this fanzine? Going up to people at gigs, which you would do. And that's part of what I say about the vibrant times. And people wouldn't so much come up to you at a gig and ask you to buy their record, but it was part of that same. It was part of that same scene.
And the amazing thing is, it's not that you had to rush home from school and start typing out something for your fanzine. You had to have something to write. So you, as a kid, you're calling people like Pete Townsend of The Who and Paul Weller of The Jam, and they're calling you back.
Yeah.
And saying, sure, come on over.
The summer of 1978, I'd done four issues of this fanzine at school. They weren't particularly good, but I felt I really wanted to do it better. And I wrote to a few people, and Paul Weller wrote right back. And actually, that same summer, I met Keith Moon right before he died. And, you know, Keith Moon was wonderful. He actually invited me to come around to his flat and see him and bring a copy of the magazine. I did. He didn't answer the door, whether he was in or not. And he unfortunately died a couple of weeks later.
Yeah.
I found that people were very, very receptive. It was maybe part of this idea that we were kicking over the pedestals and that rock groups had not been accessible. But you see, Keith Moon proved accessible, and he was part of, you know, that pedestal in a way. And I think, to be fair as well, it's hard to be rude to a 14-year-old kid. I had no agenda. I didn't have any cynicism with the people I was approaching. So I think that they saw that very quickly. Some of these groups, the Jam, were going through a backlash in 78. And I think for groups like that, it was quite refreshing to have a school kid come along who didn't have that agenda about trying to make himself, you know, famous in print for some negative reason.
Right. So now these bands, as you mentioned before, it's not the first wave of punk. Now you've got the second iteration of post-punk, of new wave. And you mentioned this band, The Undertones. The British broadcaster John Peel, who casts a long shadow in your book and in the music of this time, declares this, what, the greatest song ever, or the greatest single ever, something like that.
Yes, he does, and he stuck by that till the day he died. And I think there is there's quite a consideration that he was right. It's a song. The group was all of 16, 17, 18 years old. They were from Derry in Northern Ireland, where there were a lot of the quote, troubles were going on. The record came out on a Belfast label, self-pressed. It is the most joyous, pure power pop song, I think, that's in existence. And there's a very sweet story in the book. You know, the first time they come to London, they're on a tour with the Rizzillos. They've just appeared on Top of the Pops, and I've seen that clip, and they look so happy to be on there. They're incredibly unfashionable. The song didn't become a big hit at that point, but we were with some older kids from school who were basically the same age as the Undertones. And in those days at the Marquee, you could just walk backstage. Nobody would really stop you. So before the Undertones went on stage, we walked backstage, chatted with them. I think I said, you know, can I get an interview with them sometime? And then I said, you know, we're all in love with Teenage Kicks. How do you play it? Something came up, and Damien O'Neill sat down and showed me how to play Teenage Kicks on the guitar, and then handed me the guitar, and I played it. And then they went on stage 5 minutes later. I went out the front, and it felt like there was no gap between us. It's an amazing thing.
Let's hear the song Teenage Kicks from the Northern Irish band called The Undertones. Undertones and their song Teenage Kicks. Got a little bit of radio play here in the States, mostly on college radio stations. I know I was playing it back in the late 70s. Yeah. Tony Fletcher talking about the Undertones, the Rizzillos, that third wave, really. Because you had post-punk. These guys would have been what, new wave?
They were new wave, but this stuff started happening just on top of itself. Everything, I mean, there's a point by towards the end of the book where you have a mod revival, you have a skinhead revival, partly because of the two-tone scene, which is the Specials, Madness, the Selector, the Beat. You've got this post-punk thing. You've now got a rockabilly revival. And sadly and unfortunately, this was the peak of British tribal culture. And all these groups were basically out there beating each other up at gigs.
Right.
So the downside of this, because there was a downside, is you'd go out at night very excited to see bands, but you'd also wonder if you'd get home alive.
Right. So you have the punks and the mods and the skinheads often at the same gigs, because people would book several different acts of several different types. And then, as you say, the two-tone bands bringing, you know, black musicians onto the stage. If you're there with, you know, National Front kids, skinheads in the audience, that could be fuel to the fire as well. How you looked seems to be a part of it. I mean, you could tell the mods from the punks from the skinheads by how they dressed, right? That was an important signifier?
It was. And, you know, I had a band at school, and there were just three of us at that time. And It sort of ended up, we were in our school uniforms most of the time, but actually when we did our first couple of gigs, we realized, hang on, one of us is dressing pretty much like a mod, which was me, one very, very much like a punk with a leather jacket and a mohawk, and one is a bit of a soul boy. And I mean, we were one of the only groups that did that, because for the most part, I tell stories here of like, you know, skinheads, Zeke Heiling to the band The Selector, while dancing to them.
Right.
There's an upside and a downside. So there's a political, social story going on behind the music in the book.
And especially to some of the post-punk bands. And the one that comes to my mind, and you write about them in the book, again, the book is called Boy About Town, from Northern England is Gang of Four.
Yes.
I mean, that album, Entertainment, that first record, is sort of a screech of political awareness and of kind of musical experimentation as well.
Yeah, I think the musical experimentation is probably more interesting. I know that record was very influential in America. It was big in Britain, but it seemed to us in Britain, wow, the Gang of Four took off in America. I write in the book how they actually, you know, used the term working class like it was another breed, and they had songs like, it was Love Like Anthrax, and and they had titles. So they were coming at it from more of this intellectual position that maybe some of us thought was perhaps elitist, or maybe it meant they went to university, which they did. So they were coming as like another wave of this. They were very, very proud about signing to EMI. And they thought they'd beaten the capitalist system by doing so. And there's a story in there when the TV tries to get them to change their lyrics very, very quickly. And the whole thing kind of, it sort of shows what happens when you try and play the system from within. And you can't always win when you do that.
The song that they tried to change the lyric was the song At Home, He's a Tourist.
Yes.
This is that song from the band Gang of Four. So, Tony, that last line that we heard as the song fade away, the rubbers you hide in your top left pocket, in 79,
yeah,
that was enough to get you censored on the BBC?
Well, the Gang of Four got on top of the pops with that song, which they saw as being a big coup. And so they had rubbers, and I think the BBC insisted they change the word to rubbish or something.
Rubbish.
And if I'm right, they kind of refused to carry it through, and then the BBC never invited them back on Top of the Pops, which is probably why they ended up more influential in America than in Britain.
Gang of Four, the band.
Great song.
At Home, He's a Tourist. One of the many bands that Tony Fletcher writes about in his memoir called Boy About Town. It's a period of time in the late 70s as the early 80s, that sort of transitional period. Little labels, fanzines, bands appearing overnight. The scene is splintering. Does that remind you of anything?
You mean like the modern day?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. In different ways, we get in a lot of conversations about what music means to people right now, et cetera, et cetera. So there's certainly some of that. Yeah.
Well, it's a kind of weird little time capsule. You know, go back to the late 70s and think, wow, there's like versions of this happening right now in the digital age, which just, I guess, proves that a memoir of one young boy in South London can be a little more universal than you think. The book is called Boy About Town by Tony Fletcher. Tony, great to see you again.
Thank you, John.
Yeah. Up next, the queen of New Orleans bounce music, Big Frida, talks about the high-octane hip-hop genre and the art of rump shaking. And maybe she'll talk a little smack about the state of Connecticut. And later, the Minneapolis-based group Polisa brings its icy brand of electronic R&B to our studio for a live set. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Twerking. There's been a lot of talk about it lately. But long before Miley Cyrus made it a household word, twerking was just one of many provocative dance moves in the New Orleans style of hip-hop called bounce. And joining me now in the Soundcheck studio is the queen of bounce, Big Frida. She's been performing for well over a decade and is now the star of a reality TV show on the Fuse Network. Frida, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations. I understand you are now the holder of a Guinness World Record.
Yes, for twerking.
And it was here in New York?
Yes, in Herald Square.
Most people twerking at once.
Yes, simultaneously for 2 minutes long.
How many people? Do you know?
It was about 359, to be exact.
That's a lot of booties being shaken,
yes,
all in
yes.
one place. I should, before we go any further, probably warn our audience that various words for rear end are likely to come up in conversation because, you know,
yeah.
bounce seems to be kind of aimed at that part of the body.
It's aimed all at the ass.
Now, you've said that all the brouhaha about Miley Cyrus is, you know, much ado about nothing. She wasn't really twerking, is that right?
No, she wasn't.
What was she doing?
She was, what we call it, is exercising in New Orleans.
Exercising.
Yes. It's one of the dance moves we call it, though. It's called exercising.
Really?
Yeah. She didn't properly twerk.
What would proper twerking, that's harder to say than it seems. What would proper twerking look like?
Well, hands on your knees, back upright, and your butt going up and down, you know, giving that basketball-type motion.
Mm.
And she definitely didn't do that.
No, she didn't. But that does sort of unfortunately lead us right into our first clip, which is a song called As Everywhere.
Yes, As Everywhere, baby.
From my guest, Big Frida.
Who I might be, who I might be. As Everywhere, As Everywhere.
That is my guest, Big Frida, with Ass Everywhere, ass spelled A-Z-Z,
because
we don't want to, like, offend people.
Yes, A-Z-Z, as everywhere.
Now, you can watch the music video of this song on our website, soundcheck.org, and the title pretty much sums up what you will see. I did warn you, after all.
Yes, you did.
Now, some people, Frida, refer to your style of music not just as bounce, but as sissy bounce, because of, you know, the kind of the cross-dressing that happens, a lot of gay performers. You don't like that term, right?
No, well, it's no such term to us here in New Orleans especially. We call it bounce music. We don't separate ourselves just because some of the artists are gay. It's just one culture, and it's called bounce music as the overall. And one article was done where they entitled it Sissy Bounce, and that just started this whole sissy bounce, you know, trend or whatever, but we don't separate it in New Orleans. It's all bounce music. We have a few gay artists in the bounce game. And then the other artists in New Orleans, they kind of get offended who does bounce music when people say, oh, you do sissy bounce, but they're not gay. So it contradicts, you know, other artists as well.
So it kind of contradicts the whole inclusive nature.
Right. Yes, it does.
Now, and that seems to be, you know, New Orleans has a kind of musical history of people sort of changing identity and stuff, you know, from the Mardi Gras Indian tribes on.
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
So is this kind of, you know?
All of that comes back to it. The Mardi Gras Indians, the call and response, You know, we use all of that in our bounce music. You know, we even incorporate some of their, a little bit of the beats for us from the jazz. And, you know, all, we have so much rich history of music in New Orleans and the culture, and we try to incorporate that definitely in the bounce scene.
Now, you know, as a rapper who is also a gay man but who uses often the pronoun she, have you found that elsewhere in the hip-hop world that you kind of run up against, you know, the usual barricades, the usual kind of snide remarks or worse?
I don't have any of that. I don't usually get any of that slack, you know. There's still going to be this little homophobic thing that's going to always be out there. And no one usually come directly at me and give me any slack or whatever. I'm loved by many, you know, hated by a few. Mm-hmm. So I'm just appreciative that, you know, some of the other colleagues in the hip-hop game don't come at me in the wrong way.
We're speaking with Big Frida, the bounce rapper and star of the reality TV show called Big Frida, Queen of Bounce. I have to ask you, Frida is spelled F-R-E-E-D-I-A, so it looks like Freedia.
Right. The I is silent, and it's close to my name. My name is Freddie, so we kind of kept close to my name, the spelling and the pronunciation a little bit. So the I is silent, but it's definitely Big Frida.
Okay. And from Big Frida, here's a song called Excuse.
Big Frida coming one more time. 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 Excuse, I don't mean to be rude, but give me that mic, let me do what I do. Excuse, I don't mean to be rude, but give me that mic, let Frida come through. Wobble, wobble, get back, get back, get back, get back, get back. Wobble, wobble, get back, get back, get back, get back. Wobble, wobble, get back, wobble, wobble, get back. Wobble, wobble, get back, wobble, 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 get back.
That is Big Frida with Excuse. That many wobblies, that's tough to do. You gotta have not only the flow, but the diction and everything. That's impressive stuff. Now, you were talking about call and response. So, you can record this music, but bounce music seems to be very much a live, almost participatory thing.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. A Big Frida show, especially, live interaction with the crowd, you know, having the crowd interact back and forth with some of the different slangs that I say, that's a must.
Now, another form of Southern music where call and response is really important is church music.
So
did you start in the church?
Yes, I did. I grew up in the church choir. I was a choir director for many years. Yeah, at my church, at my home church, and at my school choir. I also went back after I graduated from high school and taught the choir. So yeah, definitely.
And when did you get into bounce?
I got into bounce about 1999 when I started backgrounding for my best friend, Katie Redd, who was the first transsexual male to come out with bounce music in New Orleans. So I was in between crossing over from the gospel to bounce music in about 1999.
Was that a big crossover?
it definitely was, but I had a lot of support of, you know, all of the people that were around me, and they just was like, you know, if you believe in it and you, you know, have faith in it, you know, go for it, and God knows where your heart is, and so I definitely went for it.
So do you ever break out the gospel singing voice, or is
most definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, most definitely. On the first episode, I definitely sung and brought it back to my roots.
And Katie Redd is on your show, right?
Yes, most definitely.
And both of you were on Tremé?
Yes.
The New Orleans set TV show on HBO. But Big Frida, Queen of Bounce, airs Wednesdays at 11 p.m. on the Fuse Network. Big Frida with me on Soundcheck today. I guess the name is kind of self-evident, but bounce, where did that come from?
It's originated directly from out of New Orleans, and it's been around before me. You know, some of the pioneers that came way before my times, the DJ Jimmys, the DJ Irvs, the DJ Jubilee, the Ricky the B, the Warren Mays, T.T. Tucker. It's just so many of the artists that came that was bouncing way before we started.
And when you say way before, do you mean like early 90s or does it go even further back?
Well, back a little bit in the early 80s.
Really?
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And in a kind of a strange way, the spread of bounce music outside of New Orleans
just recently started happening.
Yeah,
yes.
Kind of as a result of Katrina, right?
Yeah,
the hurricane.
Yes, Katrina definitely did open a lot of doors because we were displaced all around the world. And people were kind of fiending for the music like it was a drug. You know, can you email it to me? Can you, you know, mail me a CD? And Katrina definitely did get a chance for people in other places to hear New Orleans music and to get in tune to the people from New Orleans and say, oh, what you're listening to? What you're jamming to? And they'll say, oh, that's New Orleans music. You don't know nothing about that. And the other people will say, well, teach me something about
yeah.
it. And that's how the spread of it started getting even bigger.
So where did you go? Where were you displaced to?
When I first started, I left and I was in Arkansas. And then I wind up in Shreveport. I wind up back in La Paz. Then mm-hmm. I wind up in Houston and then back to New Orleans. I went several places.
Right.
But I traveled a whole lot of places to bring that sense of home and give that awesome bounce concert. They were requesting me everywhere.
So now if you go to Atlanta or Houston, do you find what you would recognize as bounce the way they make it back home?
Oh, yeah, definitely, because some of those people from New Orleans are still in those places. And the people that they taught the bounce music to, they want to come out now and represent and hold it down for New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. Has there been a place where you just found that people weren't getting it, you just couldn't make inroads?
Connecticut. Yes, Connecticut.
What happened in Connecticut?
It was my first show and my only show in my whole career that the crowd was not prepared to accept me. And they were pitching things. They were not happy. It was these young, rich white boys, and they were really upset that I was in the middle of Snoop Dogg and Wiz Khalifa. So they were not happy.
So you were on a bill with Wiz Khalifa and Snoop Dogg.
Yes, right in the middle. A queen from New Orleans.
All right. So, well, I'm sure there are pockets of Connecticut where that will happen. I'm sure there are other parts of Connecticut that will be just as welcoming as New York and
it wasn't everybody. It was, you know, because the girls were screaming yes and the boys were screaming no.
We're speaking with Big Frieda from New Orleans, a star of Bounce and star of the reality TV show Big Frieda, Queen of Bounce on the Fuse Network. Here's a song called Y'all Get Back Now.
Y'all get back now. Back now. Shake for the money. Bounce to the floor. Tune it up. Hot, girl, let's go. Shake for the money. Bounce to the floor. Tune it up. Hot, girl, let's go. Y'all get back now.
Y'all Get Back Now from my guest, Big Frieda, the Queen of Bounce, the New Orleans-grown but now quickly spreading style of hip-hop. It is hip-hop, right? I mean,
yes.
It's got the four elements, you know?
Yes, it is.
And what kind of band or... Is it all done to backing tracks? Do you have... Is Bounce built on a live music experience as well as a live
backing
dance?
Track.
Yeah.
Yeah, backing track, and I'm the vocalist. I take care of all of the vocals, and I'm feeding through the whole set.
All right. The TV show is called Big Frieda, Queen of Bounce. It's on Fuse Wednesdays at 11, and they're filming us right now here in the Soundcheck studio. So what is it like having, you know, cameras follow you around pretty much all the time?
Well, it was very nerve-wracking at the beginning until I got used to the camera crew. But once I got used to them, they was like, I didn't even realize they were there. Some things were just slipping out. It was just natural. And what was so good about the whole show, that nothing was scripted. I didn't have to follow any lines, any guidelines. I had a lot of creative control, and I was able to just be myself every day, and that's what made the show so fun to do.
Mm-hmm. So you're enjoying it then?
I'm having a blast.
Okay. Wednesday evenings on the Fuse Network at 11 p.m. The show's called Big Frida, Queen of Bounce, and she is with me on Soundcheck today. It seems like most of your audience are straight women. Is that intentional, or did it just happen that way?
It just happened that way, but yes, mostly.
Why do you think that is?
The women love the music. They are our biggest supporters, and they also draw the men in, you know. And I've been rocking straight clubs just about my whole career, you know. Rarely doing a lot of gay clubs, but my main base of fans are a lot of straight women. And they love to shake, and they love to bounce it, and they represent me all over the world.
Mm-hmm. And is that probably the demographic of the TV show as well? Do you know that yet?
I would say majority.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Frida, this has been a lot of fun having you with us here in the Soundcheck studio. Congratulations on the new show.
Thank you so much.
And the Guinness Book of World Records, holding for the most people twerking at once.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
The band Polisa has a name that means policy in Polish, but it's also one of the bands formed by a somewhat mysterious Minneapolis power broker named Ryan Olson. We'll find out more about Polisa and hear them play live next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. The band Polisa released their first record in 2012 and almost immediately attracted some big fans. Justin Vernon of Bon Iver has called them the best band he's ever heard. And Jay-Z posted one of their videos on his site Life and Times. The Minneapolis band has just released their second record, Shulamit. It's on sale now. And they are here in our Soundcheck studio to play some of it for us live. Beginning with a song called Spilling Lines, here is Polisa live on Soundcheck.
See you.
That is the band Polisa from Minneapolis, live here in our New York studio on Soundcheck with a song called Spilling Lines, which you'll find on the group's latest album, their second, called Shulamit. Let me introduce you to the members of Polisa. Chani Lena, singing and handling the electronics. Hi, Chani.
Hello.
Drew Christofferson, behind one of the two dueling drum kits here in the studio. Hey, Drew.
Hi, how you doing?
Ben Ivascu is the other drummer. He's behind our drum kit. And Chris Bearden is playing the bass. So where does the name Polisa come from? Because I think a lot of people probably look at that and think, oh, a Spanish word for police or something like that.
Sure. It's sort of, I guess the best answer I've come up with, which is true, is that it means tons of things to me, but all it needs to mean to anybody is it's the name of our band.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's about as good a non-answer as I'm going to get, right?
Well, we personally enjoyed the lack of associations with it when it got started. It was kind of, that was one thing that we liked about it, was a word that didn't really have a lot of specific meaning. I mean, we came up with a number of reasons why it makes sense, but in the end, Chani's right. It was a new word in our lives that represented this new thing we were making.
So any other answer would just be you retrofitting an answer to a name you'd already decided
basically,
on.
Basically, and all the other answers weren't as good as it's the name of our new baby.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right, now speaking of names, Shulamit, the name of this mm-hmm. new record, this is named mm-hmm. after someone, right?
Yes, it is. It's slightly named after someone, that's why I don't pronounce it Shulamit, which is how you would correctly pronounce Shulamit Firestone. It's in tribute to her, but it's not. The record is not inspired by her directly or entirely a tribute to her. She is a woman who was very influential in the feminist movement in the 60s. She was also a phenomenal writer. She was a great thinker.
Canadian, right?
She was a Canadian. She worked a lot in New York. So she was somebody who, after I'd finished writing the record, my little brother handed me her book called The Dialectic of Sex, and I read it and I was like, oh, this woman answers sort of all the questions that I had asked in the lyrics. And when you're writing a record, you're sort of like the place you're at the time of writing it, the place we are musically, the place we are lyrically, the place we are like subject matter. And it's a way to kind of like mark this time as let's move forward, remembering this person's sort of kind of philosophies more so than other things.
Yeah. So Shulamit is the record. Shulamit Firestone was her name.
Uh-huh.
And the album is out now. The band, Polisa, is playing live for us here in the Soundcheck studio. You guys want to do Smug next?
Sure.
Okay. This is on that new record by Polisa, spelled, by the way, Polica. Here is a song called Smug, live on Soundcheck.
Will it be on your soul? Some of your life, and then you're bowling.
Band Polisa live on Soundcheck with a song called Smug, which appears on the band's record called Shulamit, their second album, which is out now. Is this band, I mean, you don't have any of the visual trappings of an EDM act, you know, the banks of keyboards and the light shows and all that kind of stuff. Is this an attempt to make electronic music that is a live band thing?
Sort of, yeah. We leave that stuff at home. We have a big light set up in Ryan's room. No, we do all of our electronic production in the studio, and Ryan, the guy who writes this stuff, does it all at home.
That's Ryan Olson.
Yeah. We definitely wanted to do a band. We've always wanted to do bands, as with all of his other projects too. And it is an attempt to sort of bring electronic music and a live band kind of together in a new way. We don't really put much work into replicating the electronics live, like with live keyboards or sequencers and stuff. We just kind of let the Ableton do its own thing.
Ableton being the program.
Yeah.
Now, Channy, Drew mentioned Ryan Olson, who, for folks who are not, you know, on the Minneapolis scene, he's a bit of a mysterious guy. Who is he? What is his kind of connection to the band?
Yeah, I met him through through Gangs, which is a project that he
That's
produced.
G-A-Y-N-G-S.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He also has been in Minneapolis making bands and being in bands. He's a bass player. A lot of people record with him. He's just maybe somebody who less and less likes to be on stage, and he really likes to make music. He likes to put people together that he thinks would form good bands. He likes to...
Did he think the four of you would make a good band?
Yes. And that's what he goes off of, too, a lot of, and what this band is, like, something that we value, I guess, is people that you... keeping it small and, like, people thinking about what it's like to be on the road together. What's it like to make music together, and being personably compatible is important.
Because you're spending a lot of time in confined spaces together. It helps to... helps to like each other. I'm really glad that you guys took time out from your current tour to stop into our Soundcheck studios.
Thanks for having us.
From to the fight.
Our session with Polisa doesn't have to end here. You can hear another song that the band recorded in our studio. Just head over to soundcheck.org. A reminder, we want your picks for great books about women in music. A biography about a female musician, a history of a movement, a music book written by a woman. Give us your pick by posting a comment at soundcheck.org, tweeting us at soundcheck, or calling us at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Tomorrow on the show, Amy Tan is the best-selling author of books like The Joy Luck Club and The Kitchen God's Wife. Her new book is called The Valley of Amazement, and she'll join us with a Pick 3 playlist. The second installment of performances from the video series Barn Burners is on tomorrow's program as well. You'll hear the Vancouver-based electronic musician known as Teen Days performing in a remote barn in upstate New York. And the genre-bending string band Brooklyn Rider teams up with the banjo-bending musician Bela Fleck for a live performance. By the way, if you can't listen every day on the radio, the new WNYC app is a great way to listen to Soundcheck on the go. Head over to iTunes and download the new WNYC app for free. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.